I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Black women made history this past November when a record number were elected to the U.S. Congress, part of the largest female class of elected officials in history, although men, white men, still outnumber them. Black women also won significant victories in state legislatures and for statewide government offices. Our guests on the show today, Feminista Jones and Brittany Cooper, are black feminists, and we wanted to talk with them about this moment that we are in. The goals and vision of feminism, the Me Too movement, the upcoming Women's March, the controversy surrounding R. Kelly, their lives, and more. Brittany Cooper is Associate Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Africana Studies at Rutgers University, co-founder of the Crunk Feminist Collective blog, and her book Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower, will be out in paperback in a month or so. And Brittany Cooper, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
So glad to be here.
Also with us, as I said, Feminista Jones. She's a social worker. She's a writer, activist based here in Philadelphia, author of a book, Reclaiming Our Space, How Black Feminists Are Changing the World from the Tweets to the Streets, out in just about 2 weeks' time. Feminista Jones, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have both of you here. And let me just open up the phones and make sure that folks can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Seems we should begin with some really basic stuff here. Let me ask you first, Brittany Cooper, what does it mean to be a black feminist? And you both write about how you kind of discovered black feminism.
Yeah, so for me, it means that I care about the freedom and liberation and well-being of black women and girls. I'm a feminist because I think that patriarchy is a significant problem, the problem of male domination. I think that it shows up in black communities in the ways that black men often aspire to not only have the kind of power that white men have, but to also use that power in the very toxic ways that we often see white men do. I'm also a black feminist because I think that when we think about black liberation struggles, whether we're talking about civil rights movement or black power, too often our analysis is that to free black people, we're talking about the issues of black men. We don't talk much enough about issues affecting black women and girls.
How about for you, Feminista Jones?
Absolutely. Everything that she just said is brilliant because she's so smart. I think that the most interesting part, particularly if we think about it right now, is the idea that black women and girls have the right to exist and live free, and that our gender identity is important to us. And a lot of times black feminists get pushed back because they're like, well, you're black first. They're like, they see your black skin. I'm like, they also see that I present as a woman. So, you know, that's a hard shift. Black feminism for me, as I wrote in my book, it is the key to black liberation. Mm-hmm. If we are not centering the experiences of black women and black girls, we're not getting anywhere.
You mentioned the moment, I mentioned that in my introduction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm always sort of nervous and careful talking about whether we're in significant moments or not. But do you think, Feminista, we are in a moment?
Oh, absolutely. I think right now we are at a time where I think the gloves are off. I feel like black women have shown over decades and through movements that we are here to work, but we've been ignored and erased, as Brittany said. And I think right now we're kind of like, well, no, we're not going to be erased anymore. You're going to hear us. You're going to read from us. You're going to, you know, see us show up in all the ways that we have been. But this time we're getting credit.
Do you feel like you have some superpowers now, Brittany Cooper? Do you use the title of your book?
You know, look, those superpowers are superpowers that my grandmother and my mother bequeathed to me. Mm-hmm. And so they are not movement specific. But what is interesting is that we always see an uptake and upshift in women's movement building after we see significant movements for racial justice. So in this country, we saw in this moment the movement for Black Lives really take off in 2013 and 2014. And so I knew then that we were going to see women sort of taking to the streets, because if you look at the civil rights movement, the same thing happens, right? There's a civil rights movement. Women are in that movement, cutting their teeth on it. And then after that, you get the women's liberation movement of the late 60s and 70s. So this is really in line and very consistent. And what it also reminds me is that when black people writ large are fighting for and saying to this country, we must be free, that always inspires women of all stripes to then be reminded of their condition and then to fight for something better.
Is it different? Is being a black feminist, how is that different from being a white feminist? And you both talk about the white feminist movement or the mainstream movement as something different from what you're involved in.
Absolutely. Like, I think the idea that we bring our race into the conversations about our liberation. We cannot separate the two. So there's no way I can just simply say I am a feminist, because that kind of erases a big part of the struggles I have as a Black woman. So I bring that in. And when I talk about white feminism, I talk more about so-called mainstream white feminism, because I don't think by virtue of you just being white, that just kind of folds you into that white feminist kind of thing. But we definitely see the difference. And the primary difference is not centering race and not being sensitive to the diverse needs of women or people that identify as feminists who are also people of color.
Is it about privilege, though? I mean, do you see, Brittany, the sort of privilege part of mainstream feminism or white feminism, if I can use that?
I think, you know, I would really adopt a feminista stance here, which is that it is about a sort of refusal to recognize that women is not a universal category or experience, that's really the challenge. And so one of the things that happens a lot whenever Black women start talking about how we're Black feminists, inevitably, like on Twitter, a white woman will come over and say, why are you being divisive? Yeah. We're just all women. And it's like, no, but if like you grew up in the suburbs and if you are not being if there's a way in which your whiteness makes your femininity more valued in the world. Black women who present as Black women are often frequently misgendered as being masculine, frequently the subject of, you know, so like there's this thing about Black women are seen as more aggressive, where white women get to be seen as dainty, as needing to be protected. And so what we're calling for is a feminism that addresses those concerns. And when mainstream feminism doesn't do that, it becomes part of the problem.
You're right. I have to clean this up a little bit. Brittany, you're right. I have too much feminism stuff to spend my time hating white women.
That's right.
Right. Absolutely.
And you agree with that feminism?
No, that's absolutely. And I would say the same for Black men. Yeah. I have way more things to do than to spend my time hating the people that I'm actually trying to work with and liberate as well.
Yeah. In fact, you write, feminist, about being a Black feminist, that is often seen as a threat, or you were seen as some kind of a government agent trying to destroy the Black community.
So I don't think that there is a prominent Black feminist who has not been accused of being a CIA agent or FBI or part of an extensive COINTELPRO or, you know, installed by the government.
We're colluding with the man.
We're colluding, you know. Wow. And it's funny, I was just having this conversation that it's like this idea that white feminists cared enough about the Black family that they approached Black women to become feminists to destroy the Black family is ridiculous. Yet it's such a pervasive thought that, like, one, it's insulting to us that we have no minds of our own, and two, that white women even care enough about our families to want to destroy them. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me.
It's such a bad.
Go ahead, Brittany.
Yeah, it's such a bad account of history. The first thing that Black folks did when they got out of enslavement was to create families. My good friend Melanie Price says they created families and churches and colleges. So Black women have always been deeply interested in how to have families that took care of Black children. And what happened is that in the 1960s, because of the Moynihan Report, Black women were accused as being the cause of the downfall of the Black community because we were too strong and because we weren't allowing Black men to lead. That wasn't a narrative that was floated by white feminists. And it assumes that Black women hadn't been feminist before that moment. But if you know the history, you know that Black women have always been saying, we don't just want Black men to be free, we want to be free too. And so for a lot of the folks who think that they're representing for the race, I say you're stepping on the graves of our ancestors when you don't acknowledge that Black women have always been saying, we count, we matter, and we're in the struggle with you.
I do want to pick up on that, but really, let me quote something else from your book. You write, it's odd in this political moment that Black feminists resent white women more than Black men, because when I think of the harm I've dealt with and who has caused me the most pain, done the most emotional and physical violence, it's always, always been Black men.
Yeah. You know, look, that was a hard passage to write.
It's hard to read.
Yeah, I was trying to write against this thing where, look, I was writing this book in the aftermath of the 2016 election and thinking about how much there was this vitriol from Black women, this opportunity on social media to finally say to white women, here are the ways that you have not supported us. I think that's an important conversation. But I think that the other thing that happens to Black women is we're less likely to critique Black men that hard because we get accused of being race traitors. And when I think about my own sort of experiences with violence, having a father who was violent and other men in my community who were violent, it felt important to say, if I think about the moments when my life has been on the line, it's Black men who have put my life in peril. White women have done harm to me, but Black men have done violence to me and those I love. How do we hold both those things without letting anybody off the hook?
Yeah, and I want to give you a chance to respond to that feminism.
Yeah, I have one chapter in my book about black men and one about white women. The other 8 or 9 are all about black women, because I felt it was important to kind of address both of those issues. Sure. And I agree with Brittany. And I think we have to think about proximity, of course. You know, who's the most likely to cause us harm? Well, I think that men are the biggest threat to women and children in terms of harm. And then when you break it down by race and by class, it's the people that you're the closest to. And so, you know, my experiences with violence and with harm, for the most part, have come from black men. I agree that, like, I just stopped focusing on white women. I was just like, why are we going so hard on this? Like, I don't care. Like, we need to go back to what it is that we're doing. This whole black women will save us, I was like, ugh, that's ridiculous, and leave it alone. Let's keep focusing forward.
Well, let me have you talk a bit about your moms, your grandmoms. I mean, you both write about them, and they're both they're important people, obviously, in your life. Feminist, you want to take that?
Yeah, I spoke mostly about my mom. My family is a complicated situation and has been for a while. My mom passed away a long time ago, and I disconnected from my family because of, you know, evangelist homophobia, all that kind of stuff like that. My mom was a queer woman. She was an advocate and an activist, and when AIDS really became the thing, you know, she was definitely there, and she taught me so much about myself as a woman and encouraged me to just be out there and to speak for myself and advocate for myself. And, like, had it not been for her constantly egging me on in that way, I probably wouldn't care enough, you know, about my identity as a black person and as a woman to even try to figure it all out. So she definitely influenced me. Beyond that, my family is very interesting.
I get it. Let me give Brittany you a chance to talk. And you write about your mother and your grandmother. I mean, a larger family as well, but I'm interested in your mom and grandma.
Yeah. Look, you know, I am a Southern girl raised in Louisiana in the rural part of northern Louisiana. It took me a while. I think one of the reasons it took me so long to come to feminism is because I was used to women running everything. My grandmother was a matriarch. She had 4 daughters and 2 sons, and my mom and my aunties ran everything in my life. And so I credit them with my fire, my perspective. I write about my grandmother, who helped me to sort of, even though we are Christian people and my stepfather is a Baptist minister, my grandmother was the person who said, you know, girl, like, you need to have a sex life. Like, you need to prioritize your pleasure. And it was both deeply troubling and disturbing,
especially coming from a grandmother, right?
But also just a reminder of the creative ways that black women have related to structures and theologies that don't serve them well. And then my mother, you know, is archetypal independent woman, you know, sort of hero extraordinaire. And I write about the harrowing forms of violence that I watched my mother experience in my life, and what it meant to watch her navigate around violent men, come to a sense of self-possession, and raise a daughter who is a feminist, even though that wasn't a term that was ever used in our household. And I'm just so deeply thankful for her.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our guests, Brittany Cooper, Feminista Jones, and we are talking a bit about their lives, about black feminism. They are both authors. Brittany's book is Eloquent Rage. Feminista's book is Reclaiming Our Space. Again, you can join the conversation 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Feminista Jones. She's a social worker, writer, activist based here in Philadelphia. She's got a book that'll be out in just a week or two called Reclaiming Our Space, How Black Feminists Are Changing the World from the Tweets to the Streets. Brittany Cooper is Associate Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Africana Studies at Rutgers University, co-founder of the Crunk Feminist Collective blog, and her book Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower, published last year, will be out in paperback in early March. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Anne from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Anne, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. And I wanted to say thank you so much for having this program.
Sure.
And I'm like, Marty, I'm a longtime listener, but to have this program with my sister, the Seminista. I am now Barbara Ann Seminista. Just to let you know, that word is so empowering.
Sure.
The language to me is so important. But in the here and now, you know, when I'm still working in my communities and working to empower people, how do I get past that idea of when Black women exert their power, like they tell me it's a power grab. And that's not my intention. My intention is to be powerful,
sure,
and to empower. So my question is, are there ways that I can open the listening, especially to Black people, so that who we are, that natural power that we're endowed with, can be just part of the ethos rather than some rare occurrence.
Sure.
And when you step up, you're just shut down. And it's, you know, of course,
Well, you know what, Anne, let me just jump in here, because I think you raised a really important point, and I'll toss it first to Feminista about just Black women and how they use their power and how it is perceived. I'm sure you deal with this on a pretty constant basis, but go ahead.
I mean, what is power, right?
Sure.
Like, I think that there's a whole conversation behind what it means to be powerful and how we assess that. And we're still looking at white men as the, you know, epitome of power in the world, and everybody else is trying to be like them. What I try to do is think about the ways in which we can reflect on how we've always been powerful in our homes, in our communities, in our families, churches, schools, what have you, and try to like share those examples. And I think the main reason I wrote this book was to show that these may be names that you don't know, but these women are doing amazing things. They are shifting culture. They are, you know, when I say reclaiming our space, we're showing up in these spaces and saying, you know what? You all have been copying us for so long on these things. We're finally going to take ownership. And it's everything from a young woman creating a phrase like eyebrows on fleek and not getting a dime for it. But now you hear the phrase on fleek everywhere. And I'm like, there's power in being able to create language. And yet she's not getting the love that she should get for that kind of thing. And so I think about, you know, focusing more on the ways in which we assert power, we claim power, we hold power, just in the little things that we do and the ripple effects.
You know, Brittany, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I was thinking about this thing that came up, probably more ascribed to people like Hillary Clinton and others, Elizabeth Warren, about whether they are likable enough or not. And I'm just curious about how you see that designation.
Yeah, you know, it really makes me angry, the conversation about women and likability, because essentially what folks are saying is that women's job is to be decorations for men. We're here for men's pleasure. And so when women assert that they are intelligent, powerful folks that have their own mind, then that creates challenges. And the thing is, we're taught to see that as just a problem in white communities. But I often get shut down by Black men and have had Black men be incredibly, I mean, down to the point of being violent. I have written at the Crunk Feminist Collective about a brother who tossed a cup of water at me at a panel some years ago because I, you know, challenged him to think more robustly about gender. And so what I would say around power is recognizing that when Black women move in their power, very often that is seen as aggression. That is seen as us being angry. It is seen as us not being trustworthy. And I don't spend a lot of time trying to worry about how other people perceive me as moving in my power. Typically, what you'll see me do in those moments is just say, look, I'm endowed with this power by my grandmother, who was a domestic, by my mom, who was a single mom. And I'm not going to apologize for the way in which I move through the world, the ideas I bring to the table, or my right to be here and to invoke feminista to take up space. Too often women are put in a position where we are asked to apologize for being people with ideas and passions. I'm not here for it. And I think that it bothers folks when you won't play nice. But I'm here to say to women, stop playing nice. It's not the way that we get free.
And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Feminista, let me go back to you, because your book is about, as you say, tweets to the streets. I mean, the idea that social media is such a powerful platform, and you even describe it as Twitter as a kind of call and response. How do you see that as a way to express some of the things we've been talking about?
I think that as we have said, like, black women have been silenced for so long and our contributions have been ignored for so long that now the power really is at our fingertips. If you have access to internet, you can have a voice and you can say whatever it is that you really want to say. And I think, you know, I tell people all the time, I've been an activist since I was like 19 years old, but we didn't have social media back then. So everything we did was like word of mouth or maybe email, right? But now it's like I can say to all these people, 158,000 people, hey, let's meet at this place to protest this thing. And it spreads like wildfire. And I was, you know, able to do that. And I think that there's so much power there. The voices being heard, disabled people being heard, queer people being heard, like all these marginalized voices that have been so silenced. It's like now we don't have to wait for mainstream validation. Mm-hmm. We can actually just say it and it's here. And there's people that can receive it and spread it.
Well, speaking of protests, Brittany, let me put this to you. As we know, the Women's March is set for this Saturday. There are schisms within the march over the leadership and Louis Farrakhan and his anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. How do you see where is the march still important?
Yeah.
Are these divisions, do they tell us something important that we need to understand?
Sure. I mean, part of what they tell us is that politics is complicated and that we are not single issue people, and that part of what we have to do is figure out how to have a politics that is elastic enough that it can both expand and retract as we need to bring in different issues. This is the messiness of trying to be intersectional, of trying to think about race and gender and class and sexuality and all of these things at the same time. So what I would say is that certainly we need to denounce anti-Semitism. But here's the thing. There's a whole host of things that we can denounce Louis Farrakhan for, yes. Not the least of which is his, you know, is his views on women. And so so the idea, right, that the leaders of the Women's March are in league with him in some way, rather than that part of what women of color have to teach feminist movements is that we actually know quite well what it is to try to exist firsthand with complicated men. Men who are on the one hand marginalized by systems, men who are on the other hand complicit with those systems in the way that they think. And so we don't have to embrace Farrakhan. But if folks want to use that as an excuse to not fight against patriarchy and to not fight against Donald Trump, then they can go ahead. I think it's a cop out. And I think that we should say that there's a way to put your politics front and center and say, I don't agree with this, but we got to have a robust definition of solidarity in this moment. And part of what is happening is that we keep on saying that if we don't agree about everything, then we can't be in solidarity about some things. And that's not the way that politics and coalitions get built.
But it's interesting in the week that Stephen Representative King was, you know, finally criticized for his
mildly.
Yeah. I mean, you can quibble with how harshly he was punished for his longstanding racist comments and things like that. I mean, it's an interesting week to also think about Farrakhan in that light.
Look, it's a false equivalence. Farrakhan is not making social policy for the United States. Farrakhan is a loudmouth. He is I know that that's disrespectful to some people who really value him. I don't particularly care for him or his work. But he is not shaping the social structures that determine how people move. And part of what happens is that we think all offensive rhetoric is the same. And we think that anti-whiteness and even his anti-Semitism rises to the level of the kind of white supremacy that a sitting congressman espouses. And they don't. What we can say is that powerful, that the terrible attitudes can lead to bad politics. But let's always keep power in mind, that part of what is happening is that even when you see problematic attitudes coming out of black communities, yes, we can say that those attitudes are problematic, but what we always have to do is look at who is having the power to shape people's actual life chances and outcomes. Farrakhan ain't shaped nobody's life chances or outcomes if they're white. What he has done, which is why it's complicated, is for a lot of folks in black communities, he has been useful in helping some black people get their lives together, but he hasn't had an ill impact on any white person at any level of power. And until we can say that, then we're not having an honest conversation.
And you want to answer?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. That's been my whole stance on it. First of all, how did he get associated with the left? Because he's one of the most conservative people around. So I thought that that was nonsense. And that's when I knew that there was some agenda out there. Two, people think all black people are the same and we all know each other. So, you know, there's this grouping that, you know, if one black person says something, we must all believe that and follow that. And then finally, as Brittany said, why didn't anybody speak up about his homophobia, his misogyny, his, you know, classism? Like, why hasn't nobody spoken up in defense of the people that he's been attacking for decades? But when it comes to the anti-Semitism, everybody cares now about what Louis Farrakhan is saying and what his connection is to, you know, certain people. And I just find that to be completely hypocritical.
I want to go back to something else that you said, Brittany, which I thought was interesting. Patriarchy is America's daddy issue.
Yeah. Just a way to sort of say that. Patriarchy is one of the structuring hierarchies of this country. So when, you know, it always blows my students' minds when I say to them, look, like the reason that if you're marrying a man that he gives you, you know, that your father gives you away at a wedding is because, you know, women were considered property in this country. In many states in this country until the 1970s, women couldn't own land or get credit in their own names. Like patriarchy is a problem. And part of what I wanted to do in Eloquent Rage was to fight back even against a strain of young black activism that says that white supremacy is the primary problem that we should fight against, and to say that if we only fight against that and we don't fight against patriarchy, when what we know is that if you look at those chattel slavery roles where like black people are listed next to the cows, women and children are also listed as property. Like what we have is an issue of seeing humans as property, and that doesn't mean that I want to equate what happens to white women to what happens to enslaved black folks, but I do want to say that that narrative about property is a problem. And that it is a place that we should focus some of our activism, and not just our activism, but our analysis. And I feel like that falls out of the conversation too often, and I wanted to restore it. And that's me sort of being professorial rather than merely activist.
Right.
I hear. Yeah. Did you want to say something in response?
Pushback when I talk about what women experience, white women, right? I'm like, do you understand that a lot of the weapons and tools used against enslaved black people came from what was being used on women in Europe? Like, you know, the mouthpieces and the chastity belts, like those were already existent in Europe. And then a lot of the women that came over, especially in colonial times, they came over with, you know, buying land, having property, and then we're told if you don't get married and have children, you're going to lose your land. So when I bring up those kinds of things, I was like, that is, you know, we can't act like that didn't happen to women. We can't act like they didn't experience these things, and we can have more nuanced conversations.
Let me put something else on the table, and this is Surviving R. Kelly and Feminista. You had a piece in Vox titled Surviving R. Kelly, which of course is the documentary, and the inherent violence of being a black woman.
I just want to say that was for Out magazine.
Oh, for I'm sorry.
No problem.
It says here Vox, but it's Out.
I have one in Vox, an old one.
This is
for Out magazine.
Fair enough. You describe being a 4-year-old and being molested by an 11-year-old boy. Mm. And you say, like many black women, cis and trans alike, I don't know life without sexual violence. Mm. From the time I was 4, other people saw fit to use my body for their own gratification in various ways and at various ages. I'd grown emotionally detached from my body, a response to the repeated trauma, you say high school, college, adulthood, and I found ways to escape and suppress as a means of survival. Mm-hmm. We're talking about this moment that we're in. Do you think this Surviving R. Kelly documentary series is a moment?
Absolutely. And I'm coming from a social worker perspective, somebody who has been working with people that have dealt with all kinds of trauma their entire lives. And, you know, listening to stories for 15 years and helping people get through those things. This is a moment where a lot of that is coming out. I have taken so many phone calls because I offered myself. I'm like, listen, you need somebody, let's talk. I've taken so many phone calls, so many private message conversations from women who are just like, oh my God, when I was 5, this happened. When I was 12, this happened. You know, I suppressed this for so long, or I'm afraid to tell my family. One woman said that she doesn't want to say anything because it'll dishonor her whole family to know that her grandfather did this thing. You know, and there's so much that is coming out. And it's a moment where I think this documentary, and not just the documentary, but all the support around it has given women permission to say this thing happened to me, and it gives them permission to acknowledge it was wrong. Because for so long, they believed that it was their fault, something they did or what have you. No, I think there's a reckoning happening. And I think we are going to learn even more. And we're going to have to accept and acknowledge that this is way more common than we ever thought.
Well, and I wonder, too, whether it's a moment, Brittany, about that young black women or black women can be believed about their experience.
Yeah. You know, one hopes, although some of the community reactions to R. Kelly, even the, you know, their pictures of him doing events this last week where women are screaming, you know, hold me hostage. And, you know, and I had friends reporting that he was still being played on playlists at parties and social gatherings that they've been in since the documentary aired. Feminista and I are the same age, and we... So I grew up, too, on R. Kelly, was appalled and have been appalled since 2002 when I learned about him going to trial for or saw pictures of the young woman he molested back then. And part of what the outrage that I have and the thing that I'm always saying within Black communities is if you don't think that there's a reason for us to be feminist, how does R. Kelly still have a career? Huh. That is my question. And what does it mean that when Black girls say what happens, whether they're believed or they're not believed, what the move is often to do is to then say, well, we believe you, but you can't tell that story because it'll ruin such and such's mm-hmm. life, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's not even that we're not believed. It is that this need, this all-consuming need to protect Black men and to protect their life chances. And Black communities' obsession with trying to ensure life chances that white supremacy robs Black men of having so often happens at the expense of Black women and girls. That is the thing that is infuriating and saddening to me.
And the shift is that we know that if his victims were boys or if his victims were white girls, the outcome would be completely different. And as a Black woman, you have to exist knowing that he would have been punished severely long time ago, and he would not still be a thing if his victims were boys or his victims were white girls.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Feminista Jones. She's a social worker, writer, activist based here in Philadelphia, author of a new book called Reclaiming Our Space, How Black Feminists Are Changing the World from the Tweets to the Streets. It will be out in about 2 weeks' time. We kind of jumped the gun here on Radio Times. Brittany Cooper is Associate Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Africana Studies at Rutgers University, co-founder of the Crunk Feminist Collective blog, and her book, which came out last year, Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower, will be out in paperback in early March. You can join us. Lines open, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Feminista Jones and Brittany Cooper about Black feminism. And again, taking your calls and comments. What is our phone number here? It is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can leave comments on our Facebook page, and you can also text us as well. This little part of our conversation, probably not entirely appropriate for children, but I do want to raise it with you, Feminista Jones, because as you mentioned in your piece in Out, that you had survived sexual violence as a young person, as an adult as well. And you describe your interest in perhaps participation in the BDSM mm-hmm. culture as a way for you to perhaps take control of the situation or mm-hmm. your body, but I thought it was really provocative and interesting, and I just wanted mm-hmm. to give you a chance to help us understand it.
Oh, sure. First of all, ignore everything you thought about 50 Shades, because that's not it. Everybody always goes to that and has been for years. That's why I wrote my first book. I definitely found in my interest in that particular lifestyle that there was such a reclamation of power involved in it, and I wasn't alone. And I'd started talking to people about their experiences, and so many people had, you know, trauma in their history, various types of trauma, mm-hmm. and that this particular lifestyle and the activities therein afforded people the right to the ability to kind of shape how they could experience sex and sexuality and pleasure and, you know, things on their own terms. There's so much there about consent, and like just being able to say, I consent to this is so powerful for so many people, especially women, that I think that it's very healing. And for me, it was that, and it was like tactile, because as I said, I kind of disconnected from my body. And as a Black woman wanting to reclaim pleasure and being able to feel my body and enjoy it, I found that this particular lifestyle helped me get uh-huh. back to connecting with my physical body.
But you also say, and I thought it was very interesting, is that when you think of the enslaved women, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. they were held in bondage, mm-hmm. they were whipped, they
yes.
were brutalized in mm-hmm. many ways, but by choosing it, you sort of flip it on its head.
I think by the people that, I mean, there's so much more we could talk about, and we don't have time here, but I do think that that's a reconciliation that many of us struggle with. I did for the longest time. Like, sure. How is this happening? How do you call yourself a slave? And it took a whole lot for me to get to the point where I understood it, mm-hmm. and I got it. And then experiencing it made me get it. And it's not for everybody.
No, of course not.
It is not a prescription for everyone who has experienced trauma. We still get a lot of pushback. And for me, being a sex positive feminist and a black face for that, which is rare, I thought it was important to really speak to that particular lifestyle.
Sure. No, I thought it was fascinating. Yeah. And I learned a lot reading, and I appreciate you talking about it. Can you talk about sex positivity, Brittany?
Yeah, look, part of, for me, a lot of the work around being pro-sex or sex positive comes from growing up as a Christian girl, growing up as a real hardcore evangelical in the Deep South, and trying to challenge the way that Christianity, particularly Christianity in the Black church, conscripts Black women, because we're seeing severely declining marriage rates, but we're also seeing a continual uptick in the most conservative forms of Black theology. It's very interesting to be 50 years out from Martin Luther King, who had a social justice message, and to see Black churches really moving away from that message and towards messages that are about the hyper-regulation of the body. And so Black women often feel like, look, part of the way that we reconciled what happened when Black men were pushed out of Black homes in the 60s was to say, well, if we were better wives, if we were better mothers, if we were better at these things, then our families wouldn't have fallen apart. And the church came alongside that and said, that's right. If y'all would stop having sex outside of marriage and having all these babies outside of marriage, then our communities wouldn't be struggling. And so Black women have really struggled with that legacy. But I am a 38-year-old single Black woman and a Christian, and I spent a lot of my 20s being celibate because I thought that, you know, that was the only way God was going to send me a husband. And at some point I was like, this is trash. I need to be a grown person and have an intimate life. And so I started to give myself permission to do that. And I am on a mission to say to women, you can be in conversation with your theology. You don't have to accept it whole cloth, and that you have the right, and that it is part of our liberation project, that your pleasure matters and that you having an intimate life matters. And that if we say anything other than that, that is not what liberation looks like.
Which gets back to when you went home and your grandmother talk to you about sex, right?
So I tell this hilarious story of going home to see my grandmother, and you know how Black grandmothers are. So I'm walking up on the porch, and she just looks at me and says, "It's time for you to start having sex."
And how old were you at the
time? I was 22.
Okay.
And very shocked and disturbed and didn't know what she meant. And it's, but like, you know, my grandmother never understood like all my bookishness and all my degrees, but it's like she got me and that she wanted me to have a healthy life. One of the things that I see with overachieving Black women in particular is that regulating our sex lives has also been a part of that overachievement, because it's like if you have a baby before you're ready, then you are told that you will derail your goals. And so now you have all of the degrees, but you ain't got nobody and you don't have an intimate life that you like. And so I wanted to sort of speak to that experience and what it has looked like to try to reclaim a sense of my sexuality in my 30s, and have the agency to build the kind of intimate life that I want, so that, because otherwise I felt like I was colluding with a system that didn't want me to be happy.
Oh, interesting. I mean, that raised, both of those stories raised so many different questions, but there is, I think for a lot of women, and I'm sure for Black women, it's even more intense about being perfect, being, you know, you can't make a mistake. Everything you have to do is judged, and people are deciding whether you are a worthy person or not. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a point that Brittany made earlier about what does solidarity look like? We have to find the points of solidarity. And that's one area that women of every race can and class and what have you can connect, is on the suppression of the Black woman's or the woman's body, or femininity, or femme presentation, or what it means to be a woman, right? There's so much criticism around that. And I'm like, we need to join up about that, because shrinking ourselves in the workplace, denying ourselves pleasure when it comes to sex and sexuality, all of those things are oppressive tactics to keep us, you know, suppressed, you know, as this underclass. And I think when people ask me why I, you know, became a sex positive feminist, I'm like, if it wasn't for this body, I wouldn't be experiencing all of this oppression. So I got to start right there. I got to start with the body and this presentation that I'm in, and my choice to call myself a woman. I have to start there. And so that's really what it came. But when I think about black women and I think about the denial of pleasure, we think of how black women's bodies have always been used for labor purposes. And so a lot of us are afraid to even conceive of our bodies as being able to receive pleasure and experience it. So there's a lot of work that has to be done around that. Mm-hmm. We're not just here to work for other people, you know.
I'm making anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. You know, look, for me, I think that my narrative was one where I was cast as a goody two shoes and like carried my family's hopes and dreams, like, you know, straight A student, high school valedictorian, you know, Phi Beta Kappa college graduate, all of those things. Right. Look, it's a narrative and it's one I'm very proud of, but it is one that can become one note and very flat and doesn't allow you complication, because part of what I am trying to say to people is the pressure that we put on working class black folks to make it into the middle class. You have to be nearly perfect when you don't come from privilege in order to just have a sustainable life as a grown person. And that literally means that you regulate every part of your life. And part of what it also means is that then you are taught to use this term that we call respectability politics, where you look, you know, you look down on anyone who is not towing the line. So I grew up on Southern hip hop, which is all about booty shaking. And I loved it. But I also was taught to have great disdain for the women in videos who were like twerking to the music and enjoying it, and to see myself as different and separate and apart from them, and to say all the stuff that they're doing is going to lead to the downfall of their life and they won't be successful. And those are the narratives that we keep giving black women, that success looks a particular way. And then what I've found in my own experience is that a lot of my friends and colleagues and even me arrived at a particular age with all the markers of success, and we were miserable because we didn't have the tools to say, but what do I want to be and who do I want to be when I come home? And can I rock out to this ratchet hip hop because it's a way to release anger and stress and have some pleasure and all of that. So I wanted to sort of complicate this narrative of the overachieving black girl and to really say, look, if you don't complicate that narrative and really get about the business of being in your body and figuring out what you need in the life you want to have, this can kill you. The things that you're told will save your life can stress you out to the point where you are depressed, where you have high blood pressure and diabetes and a bunch of stress-related illnesses, and it can kill you. And that is a failure, not a win.
Mm-hmm. We began by talking. You want to say something?
No, I just grew up completely opposite. I was the hood girl who was considered a fast whore. Like, I was just out there kind of like,
this is up in New York, right?
This is in New York. You know, I'm in the Bronx. And, you know, I was in the church when I was younger and I rejected it early. But I think that it's still this merging of this path. So you can have two people kind of coming to the same conclusion that black women need to be free. Like, you know, this very hood politics, very hip hop. Again, that's why I focus so much on hip hop, because that's how I experience feminism, and how we can still merge. And I, you know, started having sex when I was 16. And, you know, it's that kind of growing. But we get to this point. You're coming from evangelical. I'm coming from this hood stuff. And we still want black women to be free.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
what really matters.
Yeah. Well, that's why we wanted the two of you together. Yeah. We began by talking about this moment that we're in. And moments come and go, Brittany. I mean, do you feel that there has been some kind of a shift here, or something has to happen in order for this moment to sustain itself?
Look, I think that we're trying to figure out whether this is going to go beyond a moment. But if black women have anything to say about it, this moment will become a permanent shift. And we saw the shift not first in politics, but in culture. Mm-hmm. It's been the explosion of black women's television shows and writing. Ava DuVernay and Issa Rae and Regina King having a sort of another stage to her career, even though she's been in the game a long time, and seeing black women leading major television networks like ABC and, you know, the Shonda Rhimes phenomenon since 2012. I mean, look, it was just 2012, just at the beginning of this decade, where we got a black woman on primetime TV in an hour-long drama. We hadn't seen that for 40 years, and so not in the span of our lifetimes. And since 2012 Scandal, Shonda Rhimes' show with Kerry Washington, now the landscape has shifted. And I do think that that cultural shift of seeing black women represented in lots of different complexity and messiness in lots of different genres has also cleared the pathway for the kinds of things that we saw in politics. And so very often, and this gets to Feminista's point, the work that black women do as cultural workers shifts what our political possibilities are. And that's mm-hmm. the thing I think we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting. I don't know how good this is or not, but if black women didn't vote, you wouldn't get a lot of Democratic candidates. Are you comfortable, Vanessa, with the Association of Black Women and the Democratic Party?
I mean, there's nothing to be uncomfortable about. It's the truth, right?
It's the truth, right.
It's a historical truth.
But do you
truth.
Feel like the party expresses how you feel about the world?
No, I'm real radical. So, okay. I'm so left of left, it's not even funny. So I kind of, like, reach for the closest raft, and it happens to be, you know, what have you. I think there's a lot going on. We are going to vote Democrat. It's nice. You know, it's just kind of what it is. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I think it's like 90-something% of black women
vote
Democrat every single time. It's not changing.
But do the Democrats return the favor?
They don't have to.
What? No, they don't.
Because we're still going to vote for them. What? So, you know, that's the conflict. And it's like, is this now the moment that black women are recognizing their political power, which I write in there, and are we harnessing it? And are we kind of holding our vote hostage and demanding change, or are we kind of going along with the status quo? Because, and I think that black people and black women get forced into these kind of situations. If we don't vote, then we're complicit in whatever happens, or if we conscientiously object, then people hate us for that. But if we vote for the white person, then you're a race traitor. Mm-hmm. Then there's just so many complicated things, and it's like, even if we don't vote, we're still going to be counted as going towards the Democrats. So. Yeah.
Hands in the air on the radio.
Like,
but you do have, Brittany, I mean, you've got a number of women in Congress now who are probably closer to Feminista than to Hillary Clinton, for instance.
I like to say we have women in Congress now, particularly black women and women of color, who have read black feminists who know what the term intersectionality means. I think that means something. And look, I'm of the both and camp, which is to say that I don't think that any revolution happens in the voting booth. I think that the voting booth is the way that we make sure, like, the light bill gets paid. And I think that what bothered me in 2016 and what continues to bother me is the way that black women are cast as parochial when we've always been the most radical, because our politics say everybody eats, everybody has a roof over their head. Mm-hmm. We want everyone to be taken care of. We want the least of these to be taken care of, whether those are children or whether they are the elderly. And that is the thing that drives our politics. And what we have is a lot of, you know, sort of hyper woke folks who are saying, well, you don't have an analysis of socialism. And it's like, yeah, but socialism is what black women do with their paychecks, right? It's like, so I just, my whole shtick in my scholarship and in my activism is to say black women are complicated and complex political thinkers. We are looking at the political landscape and saying currently we have a two-party system. If you don't vote for the one who is more progressive in a moment where the right is going even farther right, you will subject our people to the terror dome. And so is it okay to sacrifice black lives for your liberation project? It is not. And so I see black women saying, look, we're going to vote for Democrats, and then we're going to go down here on the ground and we're going to build the movements we want to see. We're going to raise radical children. We're going to teach these children about mm-hmm. intersectionality. And when we have moments where we can break through, whether we're talking about Ayanna Pressley or Lauren Underwood or Stacey Abrams, who at some point will break through, then they're going to continue to push politics to the left. Even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who identifies as an Afro-descended Latina, gets her moxie, that fire, that crunkness. Please know that that's also a cultural performance of like black womanhood too. Mm-hmm. Not taking anything away from her Latinx roots, but also saying that her commitment to the fight is her being in solidarity with the way that black women move in the world. And I see that and I appreciate it.
I just want to say that's how black Bronx women do it. So just Bronx, stand up real quick.
Well, this has been terrific, and I really appreciate both of you joining us on Radio Times today. Brittany Cooper, thanks for coming in from New Jersey.
Thank you.
Associate Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Africana Studies at Rutgers University. And again, her book, Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist, discovers her superpower, out in paperback in just a couple of weeks. Feminista Jones, thanks for coming in. And she's a social worker, writer, activist based here in Philadelphia. And her new book, Reclaiming Our Space, How Black Feminists Are Changing the World From the Tweets to the Streets, will be published in 2 weeks. I should add that both of our guests will be speaking, not together though, at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, with help today from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.